When a sensual image snuck up on me, even though my motives for leafing through a magazine were proper, I kept the normal covenant to bounce my eyes immediately. Female joggers. Whenever I approached a roadside jogger while driving my car, my eyes fixed on her, appreciating her beauty just as Steve did with the Malibu jogger in the first chapter. But trying to look away from a jogger creates a problem. I'd have to look completely away from the road not to see her. That's driving dangerously, even in Iowa. After all, I didn't want to run anyone over. Studying the situation, I found a solution. Rather than look completely away, I could look to the opposite side of the road. I discovered that it was impossible to lust with only my peripheral vision, so I used this to my advantage. My body began to fight back in some interesting ways. First, my brain argued fiercely with me. "If you keep this up, you'll cause a wreck." I considered his argument, then answered, "You know and I know that's highly unlikely." My body's second attempt to stop me was very peculiar. Whenever I saw a jogger and reflexively looked away, my mind would trick me into believing I recognized the individual, prompting a second look. My mind was so good at this that nearly every female jogger I saw reminded me of someone I knew. You talk about irritating? It took a while for me to stop falling for that deception. My brain tried another trick. As I passed the jogger without a direct look, I would momentarily relax. In the same moment, my brain took advantage of my lowered guard by ordering my eyes to glance into the rearview mirror for a more direct look. That really burned me up. I had to learn not to drop my guard after passing, and in time, that trick faded away as well. Whenever I was taken in by one of these tricks, I'd bark to myself in sharp rebuke, "You've made a covenant with your eyes. You can't do that anymore." In the first 2 weeks, I must have said it a million times, but the repeated confession of truth eventually worked a transformation in me. Billboards. Billboards are notorious for featuring some long, tall, slinky, sexy woman who seems to whisper, "Come on, big boy, buy this stuff and you'll get me too." I know of one giant billboard for a rock radio station that showed a close-up of bikini-clad breasts with this tagline, "What a pair." My defense mechanism, of course, was to bounce my eyes, but I took it a step further by remembering where the sensual billboards were placed along my commute. That way, I ensured myself that I wouldn't drive up to them each day without thinking and getting tomahawked. When designing my defense against billboards, I thought of my experience in high school driving a hotel van. We had a contract with the airlines to drive pilots and flight attendants from the airport to the hotel. The contract required that we complete the trip within 10 minutes. Only one route from the airport was short enough to make the time limit, an unpaved road with a billion potholes. I painfully learned of the direct correlation between the number of potholes I hit and the size of my tip. So I methodically memorized every pothole on that road and the driving angles necessary to miss most of them. Eventually, I could practically drive that road blindfolded and hit very few potholes. With the billboards, it's always easier for me to memorize their locations and to avoid visual contact entirely, rather than looking and then bouncing my eyes. Beer and bikini commercials. A red-blooded American male can't watch a major sporting event without being assaulted by commercials showing a bunch of half-naked women cavorting on some beach with some beer-soaked yahoos. What's a man to do? The answer is to maintain control of the remote and zap those commercials. The defense is simple. All sexy women get zapped by the clicker. Phasers set to kill, Spock. This is the best way. You can hit another station and come back in 60 seconds. This approach gives you another reason to keep the clicker away from the wife and kids. As your children watch you click away, you serve as a living example of godliness in your home, and that will speak volumes to them. Movies. We have a very good rule at home. Any video unsuitable for the kids is probably unsuitable for adults. With this rule in place, sensual movies have never been a problem in our home. Not watching randy movies is more difficult when you're on the road and in a hotel room all by yourself. Still, a Christian lives like a Christian when no one else is around, including when you're in a hotel room on a business trip. Do you remember the transport device in Star Trek that made the phrase, "Beam me up, Scotty," part of the cultural lexicon? You want to say honestly that while you're on any business trip, your wife could beam into your hotel room at any moment and never find you watching something improper. With that standard, I would have been busted repeatedly earlier in my life. Once 5 o'clock came and the business day was over, I had hours with nothing to do. That left me very vulnerable to watching cable movies, and I fell for them again and again. In defense, I set some rules. I tried a variation of my motive rule with the magazines. When I reached for the clicker to turn it on, I would check my motives. If they were clean, I would allow myself to turn on the TV, usually sticking with the news or ESPN. Trouble was, I would get bored and, without thinking, start channel surfing. The motive rule worked better with magazines because once I forfeited the right to look at them, I could get up and go elsewhere and forget about them. Not so with the hotel room TV. I still had hours alone in the room with the blank screen staring back at me, tempting me. So I grounded myself from hotel TV. I decided that I'd lost my privileges and wasn't allowed to turn it on for a while. Sound drastic? I've had some men tell me that they put blankets over their TVs to keep them out of sight. Others call the front desk and ask them to block the pay-per-view softcore movies. Whatever you have to do, do it. Receptionists. Sometimes when I enter office buildings, the receptionist might be standing upon my arrival. Telling her my name, she would then bend over to the phone to announce my arrival. Often her loose-fitting silky blouse fell open to reveal everything. It had never occurred to me to turn away. I simply figured it was my lucky day. When I began my search for purity, this had to stop. The defense was simple. Before, when I came in and saw the receptionist standing, I knew what might happen and looked for it. Now, I use this same knowledge to my advantage. When I see her standing, I avert my eyes even before she bends over. Or, if I see her walking toward a file cabinet, I avert my eyes before she bends over for that file, leaving me that nice view of her rear end. Of all the weaknesses, this one was addressed most easily. I now naturally turn away. A word on technological temptations. I want to touch on three stories that I've run across since Every Man's Battle was first released in 2000. First, consider Brady, who'd been dealing with lust and pornography for some time until he read our book. He'd learned to begin treating women respectfully with his eyes and mind and to see them as people instead of as hot collections of interesting body parts. I was doing great, and I wasn't even thinking about girls in that way, at least until the day I was in a chat room online and the chat turned sexy. Then I noticed the webcam that my dad had purchased. The next thing I knew, I was broadcasting myself to 5 girls while masturbating. When I was done, I felt so bad that I cried my eyes out. But the next day, I did the very same thing. By now, it's like I'm addicted to doing that stuff. I hate what I do, but somehow I can't seem to stop. Next, there's Craig, who met 19-year-old Clara over the internet. Because Craig was a 27-year-old single missionary, Clara immediately put 100% stock in his character. Their cell phone conversations lingered until the early hours of the morning. For many weeks, their talks centered on spiritual matters, such as when is Jesus returning and what will heaven be like. But after those conversations grew stale, the topics turned more personal. What would we do if we were alone together right now? Or what turns you on most? One night, Craig, feeling relatively sure that Clara wouldn't deny his request, asked her to use her cell phone to make a video clip of herself masturbating. Clara thought that it was the least she could do to satisfy them both, what with all the miles separating them. But after that deed was done, they were eaten up by guilty consciences. They vowed not to do it again, a promise that lasted all of 2 weeks. Even as technical virgins, they were both hooked on phone sex, until Clara's mom found her phone and the most recent videos sent. But those consequences were minimal compared to what happened to Jennifer. Jennifer was excited to land a new job as a youth pastor at her church. But before starting the position, she went on a Caribbean cruise with a friend. That's where Jennifer met Jack, a guy who thought she was the most stunning woman aboard. The only catch was that Jack was married, and so was Jennifer. Even so, they exchanged cell phone numbers. Within weeks, an occasional chat became frequent calls, and they exchanged text messages with language so steamy it could fry an egg on Jennifer's cell phone. When she mentioned wearing Victoria's Secret underwear, Jack pestered her to send intimate photos. She figured that as long as the two of them never did anything physical, then they weren't really being unfaithful to their spouses. Obviously, Jack's wife didn't agree. Imagine Jennifer's horror when her pastor and boss called her into his office, then showed her an email Jack's wife had sent detailing many of these text messages with the sexy photos attached. The first paragraph of the email explained, "I've had a private investigator following my husband around for months, and I think you deserve to know what your youth pastor has been up to." The scorned wife also copied every staff member in the online church directory. Jennifer lost her job, not to mention her husband's trust, and she is going through counseling to try and put the pieces of her life back together. I share these stories with you because there's a common thread. These people all compromised their sexual integrity, and as a result, they were publicly humiliated. But it's not the webcams or cell phones or broadband technology that are at fault. It's how these people were behaving in the first place that got them into trouble. To avoid similar problems, consider these six guidelines. 1. Hot conversation, whether by phone or by text or by computer, gets your mind racing and puts your body in the lead. Since this talk takes you from one level of arousal to the next, it's not sophisticated or just harmless fun. It's foreplay, and it works on the pleasure centers of the brain exactly like porn. Why else would 1-900 numbers be so profitable? 2. When the next new technology comes along and you wonder if what you're doing is right, ask these questions. Does it drive me from one level of arousal to the next? Am I driven to do it again and again? If so, call it what it is, sex outside of marriage. Remember, you don't have to be with someone to have sex. We call it phone sex because we get the same kick and the same high as other forms of sex, whether we're in her presence or not. 3. It's none of your business what turns her on unless you've entered into a covenant relationship with her in marriage. Ever. 4. When it comes to any form of text messages, cell phones, emails, Facebook, and so on, don't type anything that you wouldn't want someone, like your wife or your pastor, to read or hear you say in person. 5. The fastest way to put a stop to text messages with inappropriate language or innuendos is to simply not respond. Let the other person eat static. If she follows up with a "why aren't you responding" message, then you can reply with something like, "I don't play that game." And 6. If you're married, you have no business texting her, emailing her, or calling her at all. If you must contact a married woman, communicate through her husband. When you consider how you'll use any communication technology, remember these 3 stories. Think about such a possible disaster like you think of an STD. Something that can only happen when you mix sex with irresponsibility. Remember, too, that a picture is worth 1,000 words. Never, ever create sexual photos, videos, emails, text messages, or anything else that someone could keep and share in the future. Chapter 12. Starving the Eyes. As you set up your defense perimeter with your eyes, a further strategic approach is to think of starving the eyes. Remember again our definition for sexual purity. You are sexually pure when no sexual gratification comes from anyone or anything but your wife. Our battle centers on our sexual gratification. Let's picture that gratification in another way. As a man, you need a certain amount of food and water to live. The amounts differ for each of us based upon genetics, metabolism, and activity. It's even possible to suspend these needs for a while, as when fasting or limiting your food intake to lose weight. Similarly, you require a certain amount of sexual gratification. Your sex drive may be suspended by God with a gift of abstinence. and you can adjust the required volume of sexual gratification to some extent. By controlling the sexual images entering your eyes and mind, your system may become used to living on less. But in the end, you still have a certain volume of sexual gratification you need to fill. Bowls of gratification. Unfortunately, there's no unit of measure for sexual gratification, like liters or inches. But we're going to make one up, and we'll call them bowls. Imagine that your current level of sexual hunger requires 10 bowls of sexual gratification per week. These bowls of gratification should be filled from your single legitimate vessel, the wife whom God provided for you. But because males soak up sexual gratification through the eyes, we can effortlessly fill our bowls from other sources. Our sensualized culture pours sexual imagery freely with the potential to fill our bowls continually and forever. Our eyes can feast away. If your sexual need is 10 bowls a week, you can easily draw 5 bowls from the culture while drawing only 5 from your wife. That's not the same as having intercourse 5 times a week, because we can draw sexual gratification from our wives in many ways. While this bowls imagery oversimplifies the details, it clarifies the process involved in our sexual gratification. Starving the eyes. To attain sexual purity as we defined it, we must starve our eyes of the bowls of sexual gratification that come from outside our marriage. When you starve your eyes and eliminate junk sex from your life, you'll deeply crave real food, your wife, and no wonder, she's the only thing in the cupboard and you're hungry. This newfound hunger will shock her. She has been accustomed to providing you 5 bowls a week, primarily through physical foreplay and sexual intercourse. Things were at equilibrium. Suddenly, you need an extra 5 bowls from her. For no apparent reason, you come calling for intercourse twice as often. If this were all there was to it, it wouldn't seem so mysterious. To women, men always want more sex than they're getting. But there's more to it. Since your visual gratification now pours only from her, she's looking very good to you. Perhaps you haven't looked at her quite like this since you were newlyweds. While this sensation is vaguely pleasant to her, it can also be a tad jarring. Has he been taking aphrodisiacs, she wonders? She doesn't quite know what to do, except to send you outside to play with the kids while she undresses in the master bathroom. And it's not just the looking. Once you're winning the battle, you'll be saying things you haven't uttered for years, like, "I can't wait for tonight, baby." All your imaginative creativity now blossoms upon your marriage bed, not in some fantasy world. You'll be fully enamored with her. Again, this is vaguely pleasant to her, but she's also troubled. Where are these new ideas coming from, she may wonder. Has he been having an affair? What's going on? She'll probably ask you what's going on, and once she learns what's cooking, you'll both need to find a new sexual equilibrium. The extra 5 bowls from outside the marriage must now be provided from inside the marriage. From Fred, putting up with me. After I'd gone cold turkey on sexual images for about 3 weeks, I remember vividly how Brenda noticed the geometric rise in my desire for her. Constantly telling her how beautiful she looked, I was all over her, patting her, hugging her, touching her. I was also desiring intercourse far more often, and as the new higher pace continued, it dawned upon Brenda that this might not be some simple jag or a phase. She panicked, blurting out, "What am I doing to make myself so attractive? I have to stop it." That moment was hilarious. I told her what was going on and that I couldn't really help my heightened desire for her. "All my desires are coming straight at you, and I don't know what to do about it yet. I promise I'll work hard to get back to an equilibrium that we both can live with." Brenda didn't know whether to be relieved or shocked, but she expressed a willingness to allow me time to find that equilibrium and to put up with me until then. Those days revealed to me just how much I'd been stealing from Brenda by watching sensuous R-rated movies and inspecting the lingerie catalogs. Those things provide far more sexual gratification than we might expect, although Satan would have you think otherwise. When a fellow named Tom heard me speak about removing every hint of sexual sin from our lives, he said, I think you're defining sexual sin much too broadly when you include movies, ad inserts, joggers, and the rest. These are nothing. I disagreed. I was evidently drawing so much sexual gratification from these innocuous sources that once they were removed and the whole sexual burden was placed upon Brenda, she felt it. Eventually, my sex drive was retooled to live within God's boundaries, but it didn't happen until I went cold turkey on depriving myself of impure sexual images. Adjusting to purity. After going cold turkey, I found that my required bowls of gratification didn't come entirely from increased frequency of sexual intercourse. Some bowls came visually, but only through Brenda. The balance came from a natural downward adjustment of my sexual hunger, maybe dropping from 10 bowls to 8 bowls a week as I adjusted to my new sexual purity. "Wait a minute, Fred," you say. "Cutting down from 10 bowls to 8 bowls seems unfair. I'm being cheated all because I'm obeying God." I guarantee you won't feel cheated. With your whole sexual being now focused upon your wife, sex with her will be so transformed that your satisfaction will explode off any known scale. Yes, even while consuming fewer bowls. It's a personal guarantee, backed up by the full faith, credit, and authority of the Word of God. Still beautiful. We think Randy's story can help deepen your understanding of this paradox. Speaking of his wife Regina, he told us, "Things got to the point that she just didn't excite me anymore. What with the chaos of parenting and year after year of being responsible for the kids, Regina had become just a good trusted friend. She always came through in the clutch, but like any good friend, I didn't particularly find her sexy. Then one day I was making a delivery in a building downtown and rounding a corner. I came face to face with a goddess, young with long, rich black hair, long legs and heels and full breasts crowning a silky thin miniskirt sundress. I actually gasped out loud. It was totally embarrassing. My chest heaved and my mouth instantly went bone dry. I may or may not have staggered, I don't know, but I felt as if I'd been knocked cold. From time to time over the next few days, I got to thinking about Regina as I drove around at work. My wife had never been jaw-dropping beautiful, even when younger. I remembered, though, that when I first laid eyes on her, she was very striking to me and blew all my whistles. I wondered, was she still beautiful to me? One night, as I watched her prepare dinner for us, I noticed that she was still quite pretty. She was a bit heavier and her rear end hung a little, as did the skin around her eyes and neck, but she was pretty to me. Why didn't I appreciate her beauty anymore? Shortly after that, I heard Fred speak about starving the eyes. I'd never been in gross sexual sin, but I'd never really guarded my eyes either. I watched any movies I wanted, and I often looked a little too long at younger girls at work. But I really didn't think these things affected my life. But after Fred's talk, I began to wonder. I paid more attention to my eyes, and I found that they were collecting a lot more sexual gratification than I'd thought. Thinking maybe that was why I'd lost my appetite for Regina, I began starving my eyes. I couldn't believe what happened. Regina is no longer just a friend. She's become a goddess, at least to me. And it's funny, the more I draw only from her, the more my tastes change. Those little rolls of fat on her back and sides used to bother me. Now, as I run my fingers over them, they actually turn me on. Isn't that crazy? And that little bit of rear end that hangs below her underwear? Before, it only emphasized to me how much weight she'd gained. Now, that little piece just explodes my desire for her. Regina may not be a supermodel, but I'm no day at the beach either. Yet to me, she's like Miss America now. The sexual payoff. The magazines at the supermarket checkout might say, "Fantasize to a better sex life." The talk shows may say, "Let variety improve your sex life. Adultery can be good." But in God's kingdom, obedience always ends in joy, peace, and in this case, thrills. You can count on a sexual payoff from obedience. Whether your wife is wide or narrow or lumpy or smooth, when you focus your full attention on your fountain, she'll become ever more beautiful to you. Her weak points will become sexy because they're yours and yours alone. They're all you have, and you can cherish them and let them fulfill you. Maybe this shouldn't surprise us so much. After all, standards of beauty are not fixed. In centuries past, the great master painters depicted heavy, rounded women as the ultimate beauty. In the 1920s, thin, flat-chested women reigned. In the 1960s, the full-breasted, voluptuous girls were queen. And in the 80s and 90s, muscled, glistening, athletic women ignited us. Men adapt to each time period, their tastes formed by what they view. And the same will happen in this new millennium. If you limit your eyes to your wife only, your tastes will adapt to what you're viewing. Your wife's strengths and weaknesses will become your tastes. Eventually, she'll be beyond comparison in your eyes. Chapter 13, Your Sword and Shield. These strategies for bouncing and starving the eyes may sound rather simple, even easy to do, but they aren't. Satan fights you with lies while your body fights you with the desires and strength of deeply entrenched bad habits. To win, you need a sword and a shield. Of all the parts of your battle plan, this is likely the most important. Your sword. You'll need a good Bible verse to use as a sword and rallying point. Just one? It may be useful to memorize several verses of Scripture about purity as they work to eventually transform and wash the mind. But in the cold turkey day-to-day fight against impurity, having several memory verses might be as cumbersome as strapping on a 100-pound backpack to engage in hand-to-hand combat. You aren't agile enough. That's why we recommend a single attack verse, and it better be quick. We suggest the opening line of Job chapter 31, "I have made a covenant with my eyes." When you fail and look at a jogger, say sharply, "No, I've made a covenant with my eyes. I can't do that." When you look at a busty billboard, say, "No, I've made a covenant with my eyes. I can't do that." This action will be a quick dagger to the heart of your enemy. Your shield. Your shield, a protective verse that you can reflect on and draw strength from, even when you aren't in the direct heat of battle, may be even more important than your sword, because it places temptation out of earshot. We suggest selecting this verse as your shield. Flee from sexual immorality. You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 18 through 20. We've distilled this shield verse to its core kernel and repeated it in the face of many tempting situations when facing sensual images or thoughts. You have no right to look at that or think about that. You haven't the authority. A shield such as this will help you think rightly about the real issues involved as you face temptation in your fight for purity. Satan's power of temptation lies in your supposed right to make decisions regarding your behavior. If you didn't believe you had that right, no tempting power could touch you. From Fred, looking at Playboy. Once on an overnight hotel stay, I walked down the hallway to the ice machine. On top of the machine was a Playboy magazine. Believing I had a right to choose my behavior, I asked myself this question: should I look at this Playboy or not? The moment I asked that question, I opened myself up to counsel. I began talking pros and cons to myself. But far worse, I opened myself to Satan's counsel. He wanted to be heard on this issue. He cajoled and lied, keeping my mind focused on the conversation, so I didn't even notice my body slipping down the slope of lust. By the time he finished, the only answer I wanted to hear was, "Yes, you should look at it." Therein lies the power of temptation. You may fear that temptation will be too strong for you in this battle, but temptations honestly have no power at all without our own arrogant questions. Put yourself in my situation that night. Away from home on a business trip, you're walking to fill your ice bucket, and you spy the Playboy magazine. But your mind has been thinking on your shield verse, the words from 1 Corinthians chapter 6. What's your internal response now? "I have no right to even consider looking at it. I haven't the authority." That conviction leaves no room for pros and cons to drift deceitfully about your brain. And as for Satan, since you asked no questions, no conversation with him transpires. A conversation in which he could try to get you to change your mind. for the mind as well as the eyes. Your sword and shield will help strengthen you not only in controlling your eyes, but also as you establish a defense perimeter with your mind, which we'll explore thoroughly in Part 5. Here's an example. You're driving down some freeway on the way to an appointment. You and your wife have had some distance between you for a few weeks. Suddenly, an old girlfriend pops into your mind. Note the great difference in perspective between the following two possible responses. 1. Should I daydream about my old girlfriend right now? And 2. I don't even have the right to ask such a question because I don't have the authority to make that decision. The first response implies that you have the authority and the right to make that decision. The second implies that the question itself is moot. We call this second response living within our rights. If we live within our rights, God's laws of reaping and sowing protect us. Once we step beyond our rights, the sowing and reaping laws work against us. We're in mutiny, having stolen authority from our captain, and we're back within earshot of Satan. Ray was confused recently about his rights. "My wife Jan and I had a big fight the other day," he said. "I was looking at some pretty women and gave a little whistle. She got angry and said I shouldn't be looking at other women. Well, I think it's okay to look at other women. Just because I can't order doesn't mean that I can't look at the menu." Our response. First of all, we don't think married men have the biblical right to look at other women. But once a wife says she's bothered by it, all rights surely vanish. Ray stepped outside his rights when he thought he could look at other women like an epicure regarding the menu of a fine restaurant. He opened himself up to Satan's confusing counsel. Here's what he may have whispered. 1. God made them beautiful on purpose. Of course you should look. He intended that for you. 2. It won't hurt anything. You're only looking. You aren't really lusting yet. 3. Life is unbearable to live by such tight standards. God could not possibly have intended that for you. Go ahead and look. He loves you and he wants you to live life more abundantly. And 4. I know your wife is bothered when you look at other women, but she's immature. She has the problem, not you. She needs to grow in knowledge and freedom. Jealousy is a sin, and she obviously has a sin problem. Outside his rights and with his shield down, Ray was nodding his head to all 4 statements. But it didn't have to happen. Shield yourself from the power of temptation by submitting to God's definition of your rights. From Fred, What to Expect. Okay, you've made a covenant with your eyes to starve them and to train them to bounce. Maybe you've defined your weak areas, creating a custom defense for each one, and have picked up your sword and shield. What can you expect to happen over the next few weeks, even years? Here's a bit of the timeline that unfolded for me as my perimeters went up. Short-term results. The first 2 weeks were largely failure after failure for me. My eyes simply would not fall in line and bounce away from the sexual. My shields from Satan's lies were weak, but I kept plodding ahead in faith, knowing God was with me in this. During the 3rd and 4th weeks, hope dawned as I began to win as often as I failed. I can't overemphasize how dramatic and surprising this change was for me. God's blessings and gifts truly go beyond what we can ask or think. For when we sow righteousness, only the mind of God can conceive of the blessings we'll reap. I couldn't believe how much I now lived to please Brenda. During the 5th and 6th weeks, my eyes found a consistency in bouncing away from the sensual. At the end of the 6th week, I had the intense dream I spoke of earlier. The spiritual oppression lifted and the veil of distance from God vanished. Though I was still not perfect, the rest was downhill. For you, it needn't take long to raise the defense perimeter of your eyes. If you really want it, it comes quickly. More than once, men have said to me, "Fred, this is amazing, but it happened just like you said. Right about the 6th week, it all came together." But 6 weeks is surely no hard and fast rule. It may take less time or perhaps more, depending on your strongholds and your commitment to the task at hand. Long-term results. As you keep living purely, the hedge of protection from temptation grows thicker around you. If you're diligent, it becomes a much longer throw for Satan to lob temptation grenades into your living quarters. In the long term, do you still have to monitor your eyes? Yes, because the natural bent of your eyes is to sin, and you'll return to bad habits if you're careless. But with only the slightest effort, good habits are permanent. On a practical note, if you live in a four-season region, late spring and early summer calls for a fresh dose of diligence as warmer temperatures allow women to wear less clothing. Plan to heighten your defenses at those times. After a year or so, though it may take longer, nearly all major skirmishes will stop. Bouncing your eyes will become deeply entrenched. Your brain, now policing itself tightly, will rarely slip anymore, having given up long ago on its chances to return to the old days of pornographic pleasure highs. Slightly crazy? Looking back at the details of our plan, even we will admit that it all sounds slightly crazy. Defenses, brain tricks, bouncing your eyes, forfeiting rights? Man, we wonder if even Job would be a bit startled. On the other hand, maybe we should expect a sound plan to look this way. Consider all the men who are called to purity, yet so few seem to know how to do it. What's the bottom line? It took all our resources and creativity to destroy the old habits and every inch of freedom in Christ to walk free from sin. We had been owned by these habits for years, taking whatever women we desired with our eyes. Freedom from sin is worth dying for, according to Jesus. Take it from us. It's also been worth living for. The heart of a woman. As you look to help your husband in his battle for his eyes, don't look through your woman's eyes. Your sexuality is relational, so you'll assume you're part of the problem. But he has an eye problem that probably has nothing to do with you. A story about Terry and Courtney can illustrate this point. Now married, they met while attending Bible school together. Courtney is a very beautiful woman. The joke on campus was that Courtney averaged one marriage proposal per week. That means that after Terry married her, his eyes should have never strayed, right? No, his eyes did stray. Was there something wrong with the relationship? No. Did Courtney lose her beauty? No. What was the problem then? Terry's eyes and mind were untrained. His problem had nothing to do with Courtney. If a husband has a problem with his eyes, his wife often puts useless pressure on herself to improve her looks or go out of her way to do nice things for him, thinking it will help stop the problem. I thought I had to make myself look nice for my husband, Heather said. I thought I should be giving him back rubs, sitting down and talking to him, and really listening when he came home. Such things won't change her husband's eye problem, however, if he has one. Men certainly will appreciate your efforts to look your best. Andrea said, I do my part to make sure he has no reason to have wandering eyes. Even if I'm just home all day with nowhere to go, I still do my hair and makeup and wear nice clothes. But if a man has eye problems, it isn't because his wife needs to look more enticing. For the most part, Brenda said, it seems that it's the husband's job to be pure. I don't really see a lot in this chapter that relates to women. We can't control joggers, receptionists, or billboards. This is mostly stuff that men must handle on their own. It's more their battle than ours. Your husband won't complain if you try to look nice, and as you seek to help, here are some other useful ideas. 1. Watch what he watches. Let's say it's a quiet Saturday night and you and the kids decide that an evening of watching professional figure skating is the perfect family night activity. You've settled in with popcorn and your daughter's eyes are aglow with anticipation. Your husband may find at this time that viewing female skater after skater in next-to-nothing outfits is too much. If he begs off and wants to putter around in the garage, let him. 2. Help him find the new equilibrium. When he goes cold turkey and his hunger for you escalates, help him without complaint. Does this mean I have to dance around like some saloon girl? No. You needn't wear leather and chains, nor take a yogurt bath with him. He just has a heightened hunger for you. Simply meet it with a caring, respectful softness and willingness until an equilibrium is found. 3. Diffuse the 72-hour cycle. As we mentioned before, when men aren't getting regular sexual release, their eyes are more difficult to control. Help him out in this battle. Give him release. Does that mean he should have sex any time he wants? Of course not. The Bible says you should not withhold sex for long periods of time. But men love to interpret that scripture incorrectly by saying they have a right to intercourse as often as they want. We've heard stories about some husbands who coerce their wives into sexual intercourse 1, 2, and sometimes 3 times a day. Perhaps your husband needs to be reminded that it's a 72-hour cycle, not a 72-minute cycle. If your husband is demanding sex more than once a day, he likely has a lust problem that needs to be dealt with, or he's a borderline sex addict who needs therapy. 4. Allow him to ogle you a bit. Let him see you come out of the shower naked. If he can no longer be drawn elsewhere visually, let him draw from you. You may not care much for your own body, and you may not want to be ogled, but you'll look better and better to him. And 5. Do regular checkups. As we've said before, you're not to be his accountability partner, but checking up on him with humor and grace helps him while also encouraging you and making you feel more secure. When we're driving along, Kathy said, and we come up on some lady jogging in black tights, I probe a little deeper to see what his reactions were when he saw her. Ellen added, I have watched to see whether he looks over at the Cosmo-like magazines found at the supermarket checkout. He does well. It's good for a man to know that his wife is watching from time to time. It helps keep him strong. Part 5. Victory with Your Mind. Chapter 14. Your Mustang Mind. As you build the outer defense perimeters, you'll find that the perimeter of your eyes goes up much faster than the perimeter of your mind. Why? First, the mind is far more crafty than your eyes and more difficult to corral. Second, you really can't rein in the mind effectively until the defense perimeter of the eyes is in place. Knowing this, you shouldn't be discouraged if your mind responds more slowly than your eyes. The great news is that the defense perimeter of the eyes works with you to build the perimeter of the mind. The mind needs an object for its lust, so when the eyes view sexual images, the mind has plenty to dance with. Without those images, the mind has an empty dance card. By starving the eyes, you starve the mind as well. Although this alone is not enough, the mind can still create its own lust objects using memories of movies or pictures you saw years ago, or by generating fantasies about old girlfriends or the women with whom you work. At least with your eyes under control, you won't be overwhelmed by a continuing flood of fresh lust objects as you struggle to learn to control your mind. Your mind coming clean. Currently, your brain moves nimbly to lust and to the little pleasure high it brings. Your brain's worldview has always included lustful thinking. Double entendres, daydreams, and other creative forms of sexual thinking are approved pathways, so your mind feels free to run on these paths to pleasure. But your mind is orderly, and your worldview colors what comes through it. The mind will allow these impure thoughts only if they fit the way you look at the world. As you set up the perimeter of defense for your mind, your brain's worldview will be transformed by a new matrix of allowed thoughts, or allowables. Within the old matrix of your thinking, lust fit perfectly, and in that sense was orderly. But with a new, purer matrix firmly in place, lustful thoughts will bring disorder. Your brain, acting as a responsible policeman, nabs these lustful thoughts even before they rise to consciousness. Essentially, the brain begins cleaning itself, so elusive enemies like double entendres and daydreams, which are hard to control on the conscious level, simply vanish on their own. This transformation of the mind takes some time as you wait for the old sexual pollution to be washed away. It's much like living near a creek that becomes polluted when a sewer main breaks upstream. After repair crews replace the cracked sewage pipe, it will still take some time for the water downstream to clear. In transforming your mind, you'll be taking an active conscious role in capturing rogue thoughts. But in the long run, the mind will wash itself and will begin to work naturally for you and your purity by capturing such thoughts. With the eyes bouncing away from sexual images and the mind policing itself, your defenses will grow incredibly strong. Lurking at the door. With that confidence, you'll want to be doing all you can to push along your mental transformation. A helpful concept of something to be on the lookout for is the scriptural imagery of lurking at the door. Job mentioned it. Just a few verses after we read about the covenant he made with his eyes, we hear Job saying this: "If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then may my wife grind another man's grain, and may other men sleep with her. For that would have been shameful, a sin to be judged." Job chapter 31, verses 9 through 11. Have you lurked at your neighbor's door? It could mean stopping by in the late afternoon, visiting your friend's wife for coffee, enamored by her wisdom, care, and sensitivity. You felt sorry for her as you've commiserated together over her insensitive, brutish husband. You held her as she cried. You were lurking at your neighbor's door. Consider Kevin, who is married with 3 kids. While working with the youth group at church, he met a beautiful 15-year-old girl. "She's a knockout and looks more than 20," he said. "Sometimes I'd ask about boys she's known and dated, and we'd joke and laugh a lot. But sometimes I went too far. We'd get to talking a little trashy, what she liked when kissing, what I bet she wouldn't do with a guy, that sort of thing. I knew I shouldn't talk to her like that, but it was exciting. Last week, when my wife and kids were out of town, I gave this girl a ride home. We got to talking dirty again, and somehow I bet her that she wouldn't pull her pants down for me. She did. I lost my senses, and I drove her to a park, and we had sex. I'm in real trouble. She told her parents about it, and they may press rape charges." Kevin wasn't just lurking at his neighbor's door. Kevin was inside his neighbor's door. Mental lurking. Maybe you've never done what Kevin did, but you've been lurking at your neighbor's door just the same. According to Jesus, doing it mentally is the same as doing it physically. You know you've lurked. Your friend's wife seems more like your type than your wife does. Why didn't I meet her sooner, you wonder? How different things would have been if I had. Maybe your old girlfriend is married now, yet you lurk at her door in your mind, wondering if she misses you, secretly hoping to run into her at the mall. Or you've been lunching with a group at work, including that beautiful young sales associate, getting so attached that you're depressed whenever she calls in sick. The last time you sent her an email saying, "I missed you today. Hope you feel better soon." Maybe you've connected with a woman in a chat room and you imagine what she looks like and what life with her would be like. You're lurking at your neighbor's door. Wild thinking. As we've seen, most sexual impurity is generated from women you don't even know. You essentially view them in passing. Models, actresses, receptionists, and pinups are everywhere. But they're strangers. You don't live with them, so training the eyes defends against them. But bouncing your eyes cannot screen out those live attractions, attractions from your interactions with women. These women aren't strangers. You live and work in close proximity with them, even worshiping with them on Sundays. Impure thoughts and attractions may arise. Since the defense perimeter of the eyes can't stop them, you need another defense. "What am I supposed to do?" you say. "Those thoughts come on their own. I can't help them." That certainly seems true, since controlling the mind can seem bizarre. Even in church, a daydream may suddenly transpire about some woman at work. Where do these thoughts come from? The mind is like a wild Mustang running free, one thought triggering another in no real order. Still, the Bible says we must control not just our eyes, but our whole bodies. You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your body. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 19 and 20. And not just our bodies, but our minds as well. The Holy Spirit, through Paul, is clear on this. "We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 5. This is a jarring verse. Reading it, it's easy to wonder, take every thought captive? Is that really possible? Your mental custom station. All impure thoughts generate from processing both visual and live attractions through your senses. Viewing women on the beach, flirting with the new woman at work, remembering an old girlfriend. During improper processing, our minds can get carried away in impurity. However, by properly processing these attractions, we can capture or eliminate impure thoughts. We've already discussed one form of proper processing called bouncing the eyes. It processes visual attractions by training the eyes to bounce and then starving them. When it's effectively established, your defense perimeter of the eyes has the nature of the old Berlin Wall. No visual entry visas are ever granted for any reason. But the defense perimeter of the mind is less like a wall and more like a customs area in an international airport. Customs departments are filters, preventing dangerous elements from entering a country. The U.S. Customs Service attempts to filter out drugs, Mediterranean fruit flies, terrorists, and other harmful agents. Similarly, the defense perimeter of the mind properly processes attractive women into your country, filtering out the alien seeds of attraction before the impure thoughts are even generated. This perimeter stops the lurking. Consider the situations of two men we've talked about. Wally, the businessman who dreaded being alone in hotel rooms, found that after turning off the TV, his mind still raced with images in circle after circle of lustful bombardment until he couldn't sleep at all. Had he granted no visual entry visas by watching TV, no lustful thoughts would have been born. The situation is different for live attractions. Kevin was a youth group leader, and that 15-year-old girl was a youth group member. She had a valid entry visa into his life. He had to interact with her. Of course, he didn't have to interact improperly. Attractive women will pass through this defense perimeter, but they must only be allowed to enter for appropriate purposes. Filling in the blanks. What happens at our mental custom station? Say your company hires a new coworker, Rachel. On her first day, Rachel walks around the corner, starts talking, and wham, you're attracted. From this point, she can either be processed properly in your mind without generating impure thoughts, or you can mishandle the situation. What happens next is critical to the purity of your mind. You continue interacting with Rachel over time. The early interactions feed the attraction. For instance, Rachel might return your attraction signals, or her sense of humor may match yours. She loves your favorite pizza. She's simply mad about football. Rachel is refreshing and fascinating, so you love to think about her. At this point, improper processing carries you away into sensual thoughts and other impure practices like flirting and teasing. At worst, you can be swept away like the foolish young man in Proverbs 7. With persuasive words, she led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once he followed her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. Proverbs chapter 7, verses 21 through 23. Your mind gets lost in the attractions. It doesn't really matter that you don't know Rachel very well. Early in the relationship, the mind is nimble in filling in the blanks with its creative imagination. That's part of the fun. The less you know about her, the more blanks there are to fill, and the more your mind can run with its fanciful thoughts. With further interaction, however, more facts dribble in. With fewer blanks to fill, the mind quickly gets bored. Facts are the killer virus of attractions. What kind of facts? Once you've heard her talk about her wonderful new baby and how great her husband is, it becomes harder to imagine Rachel as your enchantress in waiting. She falls off your attraction screen, becoming merely a friend or coworker. From Fred, Learning the Right Mental Processing. Probably all of us can think of an example from high school where our minds got lost in our attractions. I had one in high school. Her name was Judy. I noticed her early in my senior year when Judy was a junior. You talk about hitting attraction buttons. I was carried away into a land of silly dreaminess whenever I thought about her. I thought about what I would say and how we would love each other and where we would go, my mind filling in billions of blanks since I knew nothing about Judy except her name and her grade. All year long I dreamily longed for her, watching her bounce merrily by, hoping for the day we could speak. I yearned to ask her for a date, but I lacked the courage. Even though I was the super stud athlete of the year, with girls my heart turned into raspberry jello. As the year wound down, one chance remained, the senior prom. Struggling fiercely, I dialed her phone number. After some meaningless small talk, I stammered out my request. She actually said yes. Her melodious voice affirmed my existence, and you can imagine what my mind did with that. After the prom dance, I found the perfect place to take her, the Iron Men Inn. While the traditional site for after-prom dinners was the Highlander, I decided that I couldn't give my newfound love something so trite and dreary. In the secluded curtained booths at the Iron Men, we could sit transfixed and not be interrupted on that glorious first night of the rest of our lives together. After being escorted to our booth, we bantered lightly, my heart pounding deeply within me. My attraction grew with each passing moment. Quietly secluded at the Iron Men, the hostess romantically drew the curtains. Judy's ravishing face glowed and her lovely full lips parted to speak. Enchanted, I listened dreamily, only to hear her say, "You know, I don't know how to say this, but I really, really wanted to go to the Highlander. Do you mind if we go over there?" Clunk. Though my attraction for her shuddered wildly, chivalry and honor carried the day. Mustering an air of nonchalance, I responded, "Sure, I guess so," though I knew this wasn't good for our date. At the Highlander, we stood waiting to be seated. Judy brazenly asked, "Do you mind if I go over to Joel's table for a while?" She left me and spent the rest of the night with him. I ate alone with my thoughts, musing, "This is why I like football better than girls." Later, she graciously threw me a bone, allowing me the honor of driving Her Highness home. She confided that she'd hoped all along to find a way to be with Joel that night, since he hadn't asked her to the prom as she had expected. My attractions to Judy died that night. The facts did them in. Initially, I didn't process my attractions to her properly at all. But let me share an example of someone who did process some attractions well. Kirk told me about Patricia, a new woman in his engineering department. When he first saw her, she was giving a presentation to the whole group, and he was hit between the eyes. I was sitting there expecting another boring presentation when up bops Patricia. She was pretty and intelligent, yet she had an airy disposition. She reminded me so much of the girls I knew back in college. My mind kept insisting, "I've got to get to know this girl. I've got to get to know this girl." But I was married, and I knew I shouldn't. My mind kept demanding to think about her. She seemed so attractive, but I knew I shouldn't think about it.